From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the birth of one of the most significant technological developments in history. We're talking about the electrical grid. And New York State is essentially the creator of the modern grid, but modern isn't so modern anymore. In a new op-ed for the Times Union, Suzanne Hunt and Jigar Shah write that New York needs to be at the forefront of reinventing the grid. And if you're looking for something to top the list of 2018 climate priorities, this might be it. That's because so much of the climate action movement has moved to the state level. The Trump administration has taken a number of steps to give advantages to the fossil fuel industry. In the meantime, states like New York have adopted the Paris standards, but there are many other ways that states can address climate. And this hour, it's kind of a year in review for climate action and a look ahead at 2018 priorities at the state level and beyond with someone who has worked in this in Washington, now in New York State, someone who's consulted with private businesses, but also government, and has a lot of experience in a lot of different sectors. That's Suzanne Hunt, who is the co-author of that op-ed I just mentioned. She is president of Hunt Green LLC. It's always great to have you back here. Thank you for being here, Suzanne.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And as you know, if climate change were real, you wouldn't have any trouble driving in the snow today. So what do you have to say about that?
You know, it's interesting. One of my favorite innovator farmers wrote to me this morning and was saying that people just don't understand that climate change means more extreme, more
violent
weather.
Can we out him? I saw the comment. That's Klaus Martens, right?
Yes. And yeah, climate, when you put more energy into a system, everything happens. Everything's more energized. So when you get cold, you get colder. When you get hot, you get hotter. When you get dry, you get drier. And everything's just more extreme and volatile and difficult.
I know. It should have been obvious, and I was being cheeky. But occasionally, we still get those comments like, yeah, some climate change with all that snow there. So we got that out of the way. It's great to have you back here, and thanks for making the trip here. And we're going to get back to your op-ed in a second. I was saying to Suzanne when she came in here that I do want to work through what's going on at the state level, and then we'll look at national, international. But there is one headline that is super immediate, so I just want to point directly to The Guardian, because here was The Guardian headline regarding what's going on with the World Bank. I'm going to quote from The Guardian yesterday. Quote, "The World Bank will end its financial support for oil and gas extraction within the next 2 years in response to the growing threat posed by climate change. In a statement that delighted campaigners opposed to fossil fuels, the World Bank used a conference in Paris to announce that it will no longer finance upstream oil and gas after 2019. The bank ceased lending for coal-fired power stations in 2010, but it has been under pressure from lobby groups also to halt the $1 billion a year it has been lending for oil and gas in developing countries. The bank said it saw the need to change the way it was operating in a rapidly changing world, adding that it was on course to have 28% of its lending going to climate action by the year 2020. At present, 1-2% of the bank's portfolio is accounted for by oil and gas projects. And again, that's going to be zero in a couple of years here. What's your response to that news here? I mean, is that a big pelt on the world stage? Is that symbolic? How meaningful is that to you?
It's very meaningful. There's still a long way to go, but folks who follow these issues have been pressuring the World Bank for years on this topic because, you know, it's not just the size of their portfolio, but it's the influence that they have and the experts that they have. And for years, the staff at the bank would argue that, you know, if we're not there, it'll be done worse than if we're there trying to put some guardrails and safeguards in place. And the flip side, the other argument is that you guys are going in there and helping facilitate this, and you're putting public resources, public dollars, towards projects that are harming the planet and harming, the future generations. So it's really important because that money can now go into the solutions and in areas where people are suffering the worst from climate change.
All right, listeners, as we go throughout the program this hour, if you want to call with your thoughts on the year in climate action and a look ahead, 844-295-TALK, that's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994, and please do not talk to me about the snow or the low temperatures today. So let's talk about on the state level here. Suzanne was the co-author of a piece for the Times Union titled All Revved Up with No Place to Go. And I want to quote a paragraph from that, and we can talk, kind of work our way through it, because I think it's important for you to lay out what exactly is going on, and then what the possible consequences and benefits are if it goes in certain directions. So from Suzanne's piece, quote, New York State has been working for 3.5 years on the Revising the Electricity Vision process, REV, known as REV. The purpose is to enable the transition to a modern, distributed, clean electrical grid that includes critical energy storage technologies. Much emphasis has been put on solar power and other renewables, but 3.5 years into the process, there are still no clear market guidelines for energy storage, meaning that many of the critical technologies needed to modernize and harden our grid to both natural and man-made disasters cannot be deployed at meaningful scale in the Empire State. End quote. So there's sort of a, it feels like a kind of a good news, bad news edge to this. Take me through why this is so pressing right now here. What's going on?
Well, so you know, the whole world and the whole country is grappling with how we transition from the old centralized dirty grid that's quite vulnerable to natural disasters and man-made disasters, terrorist attacks, that kind of thing, to a modern distributed grid based on cleaner, safer technologies with a lot more public engagement, public involvement, public ownership. You know, it used to be that only huge, massive companies and utilities owned power production, and now anyone can own some of that production. So, you know, that's a difficult transition, and it's not like the electricity markets are like widget markets. You know, you can't freely buy and sell and set your price. The prices, all of the rules of how the electricity markets worked are, you know, a construct of the regulators. So when we talk about trying to make market forces work and markets work, we have to talk about that within the confines of the highly regulated, highly controlled electricity markets.
And I'm looking at some of what you're telling me here, because we've been on this program before talking at length about the grid and ways to modernize it and how it works. And this is a state that at least feels myopically living here, like it's at least a little forward-thinking when it comes to different forms of energy, and I'll ask you in a minute if you agree with that. But then again, when you say that many of the critical technologies needed to modernize and harden our grid cannot be deployed at meaningful scale, that feels a little bit like a surprise, given the fact that it feels like we're sort of forward-looking. Are we forward-looking in this state on this issue?
No, absolutely. And New York State and our public servants deserve a lot of credit for being public-looking, or excuse me, for being forward-looking and for all of the work they've done so far to try to struggle with this difficult historic transition. And the reason we wrote this piece and the reason we're starting to poke and prod right now, because as you know, Evan, you know, I've been incredibly supportive. And so, you know, Jigar was on the board of NYSERDA up until recently. And we've put enormous amounts of time and energy and blood, sweat, and tears into supporting this transition. And we felt like we had to, put some pressure on right now because, the REV process has been going on for 3.5 years, and we're seeing companies just give up on New York and go to other states. We're seeing companies.
What kind of companies?
Solar companies, wind companies, battery companies, companies that have software that rather than spending money on batteries, which are still costly, rather than spending money on, these expensive peaker plants that only run a few hours or a few days a year. And so you have to pay to maintain them 365 days a year just to run them for a tiny amount of time. Instead of that, there are all kinds of software and technologies and companies that would love to be able to just use, control your smart appliances, control your thermostat, and for a fraction of the cost, and with reducing all emissions, reduce the amount of energy needed at that moment for those moments, so that you don't have to turn those dirty plants on. You know, those kinds of companies, until the Public Service Commission and until New York State clarifies the market guidelines for these new technologies and how they'll be compensated, we can't put together deals. We can't do projects. We can't finance things because we don't know what the economics are going to look like.
And so, what's the legislative role?
What's happened now and what catalyzed this particular conversation was the battery bill. That was sloppy. The energy storage bill, which is important because there's lots of technologies. Batteries are just one that folks are familiar with and excited about, but there's lots of different ways to store energy. You know, because the rev process has been taking so many years and there aren't clear timelines for when it will be done, and companies are getting, you know, frustrated and just, you know, they can only spend money paying staff to participate in working groups for so many years before they say, we just we're a business, we have to allocate our resources where there'll be a return. So the legislature decided to pass a law to force the issue with energy storage because it's so critical to this transition. And so there's a debate going on about mandates versus market forces. And I think it's time for some really clear dialogue around how that actually gets done, because until you have the market rules in place, until you have a vibrant market, sometimes you do need mandates. You know, Jigar, I wish Jigar could be on it. I think he just had to cancel last minute, but he's made millions of dollars in clean tech. He just raised a second $200 million to invest in these technologies. And, you know, he is a full believer in capitalism, but he will say that, you know, sometimes mandates are needed to catalyze markets and catalyze the rule changes.
All right. So I want to weave together a number of threads with climate action based on exactly what you just said here, because I want to stay focused on exactly this issue while also bringing in some broader questions. A year ago, this country was preparing for a presidential transition. And what I heard from climate activists was a couple of sentiments on the federal level. Number one, concern about the rhetoric coming from the candidate and then president-elect Trump, combined with the idea that at heart he's a businessman and he will see that there is a market for alternative energy, for new energy, for clean energy, for whatever term of art you want to use. He will see that there is money there and that there is innovation opportunity and entrepreneurialism and all of those things, and that will win over all of the rhetoric. And so let me start by asking you if you think as we assess 2017, I told Suzanne before this program began, I'm not a big fan of calendar journalism shows, year in review, but there are certain subjects I think that is valuable. And this is one of them because we're getting a better picture now. Which of those concerns versus optimism has borne out on the federal level for you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Trump if we don't have to. But, you know, the whole thing about how he's a businessman and I'm a deal maker, and then he goes and you know, does things like give Israel the Jerusalem issue without getting anything out of it for other, you know, I mean, I'm just, that whole argument is just, is out the window. That's, you know, that's gone. And I think in terms of the energy future, you look at Bloomberg, you look at all kinds of businessmen who come from a more conservative background, and they are putting their money in clean energy. And I think, you know, with Trump and politicians, you dance with the one who brung you. You know, he's dancing with the oil and coal guys because they're the ones that helped him get elected. And so the fact that the money-making opportunities, the fact that coal cannot compete with low-cost natural gas and with low-cost renewables, that is the reality in the marketplace. And one of the interesting upsides of the, you know, terrible Trump administration policies on energy is that it's showing that all of their talking points and myths that they're spreading about how, you know, it was the Clean Power Plan that was killing coal are proven wrong, because coal is still dying and they're rolling back the Clean Power Plan. So, you know, I think one of the things that their terrible policy is showing is that all of those arguments that they were trying to make are truly false, and the market is showing that.
Okay, but we aren't seeing a businessman who pragmatically sees the money there. He is, in your view, kowtowing to the big money that brought him into office.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that's why I hear so much more emphasis on the state level. So now let's peel back to the state level, and let me ask you, was this a sort of an up or a down year at the state level? Maybe a lot of it depends on what happens going forward in 2018. So let's go back to this grid issue. The best case scenario is we're sitting here a year from today talking about what happened in 2018 on the grid issue. What is a realistic set of accomplishments that could happen in the next 12 months on this?
Well, let's start with the looking back.
Yep.
And let's just, you know, give credit where credit is due. You know, there's a lot of progress on really important things like offshore wind. You know, that's going to be critical to meeting New York's climate and clean energy goals. That was a huge progress in offshore wind. So bravo to New York for getting that done. You know, there's New York has been really active in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. New York incentivized electric vehicle purchases, which increased by 74% this year. They did phase two of their New York Prize competition to advance microgrids in New York State. So there's a lot of good progress. There's the Clean Energy Communities program that moved forward. The 76 West competition and incubator. And then at the grassroots level, at the citizen activism level, that's another positive outcome of the terrible Trump administration policies is citizens have realized that they actually have to get involved and they have to put time and effort into this. They can't just leave it up to someone else. And so there's been wonderful engagement and activity at the grassroots level. I just spent yesterday with the Energy Democracy Alliance, which is just this completely grassroots coalition of citizen organizations from across the state, totally diverse, age, color, gender, background, that are all learning about these issues and trying to get good projects done together.
When it comes to that citizen engagement, is this a level that you've never seen in your career working on these issues, whether it's in Washington or in New York State?
You know, I hadn't thought of it like that, but I think, I'd have to agree with you. I think there have always been, that small group of dedicated people that change the world. That's always been there. But it's clear that, a lot more people are needed and they're starting to engage. So it's great.
Okay. And so you're looking at some of the positive things that have come out of 2017. When you look at 2018, we're going to go through your priorities, starting with the grid then. And so what could actually happen here? I mean, what's going to happen in the next 12 months that will make you say, and people like Jigar Shah, who co-authored the piece with you in the Times Union, that this has gone exactly the way that you think our climate urgency needs it to go?
Well, I wish we had planned this days in advance so I could have a really clean set of policy recommendations ready, but I might have to write a follow-up piece after I've interviewed a whole bunch more colleagues and been able to do some more analysis. But, the first few things that come to mind, there's still an open seat on the Public Service Commission, and one of the things that the grassroots citizens have been asking for is a citizens commissioner. So usually they come from utility backgrounds, they come from industry backgrounds. Put someone on the commission that represents regular citizens. So that's one thing that the state could do, or someone who's at least dedicated to driving this energy transition forward as fast as possible. The energy storage bill that was just passed has a requirement for the Public Service Commission to set and for the state agent, state entities to set a target and give it teeth or not. So that's another thing. Part of why we're in the dynamic that we are now is that, there's a lot of pressure on public servants from the existing industry not to rock the boat. If you're a publicly the utilities that we have in the state get a guaranteed return of something around, it's usually around 10%. They don't want their shareholders don't want that threatened, and it is currently threatened by this clean distributed energy transition. And so there's a huge amount of pressure on the public servants to slow these processes and not to change the system. So empowering and facilitating and enabling those public servants to get these market guidelines updated, that would be one of the biggest priorities for 2018.
Your piece calls for putting pressure on the legislature, the PSC, the governor. What would the governor say, who's never been on this program, what would the governor say if he were sitting here listening to some of your, both your praise for what's been happening at the state level, but also a critique of what's going on in this particular issue?
I don't claim to know what's going through Governor Cuomo's head. I think it's pretty well known that climate change isn't, one of his core issues. He's not a climate guy. He really depends on...
You think he would say that? I don't think he would say that.
No, but I think that's kind of understood.
Okay.
There are certain politicians where this is something that it's one of their top priorities and they drive it forward. I think in the case of Cuomo, he's balancing lots of different things and he really depends on his staff and his team. And in New York, it's our energy czar, Richard Kaufman, to handle this and to move this forward. And so I think he would say, I have confidence in my people to do a great job on this. And out in the public, he's out there. When Trump said we're pulling the United States out of the Paris Agreement, Cuomo was one of the state governors that said we are not pulling out. And one of the thousands of university heads, governors, mayors, you name it, that said, no, we're going to meet our climate and our Paris commitments. So I think he would say New York is leading, and it's, you know, it's slower and more difficult than we would have liked, but we're committed to this.
And when it comes to benefits of getting these kinds of issues done in 2018, I want to go back and read a little bit more from your piece then. You write that, quote, widespread deployment of energy storage will benefit New Yorkers in a number of important ways. Energy storage enables the wide-scale deployment of renewable energy, enhances electric grid efficiency and resilience, provides grid flexibility by being able to both take excess energy from and inject energy into the grid instantly without the warm-up time needed to start up conventional combustion plants, improves power quality through frequency regulation and other ancillary services, and minimizes load pocket congestion. It can also help replace older, dirty peaker power plants, usually natural gas plants that may only turn on for a few hours or a few days per year, with clean emissions-free energy sources. Effective energy storage does all of this while ensuring grid reliability, saving New Yorkers billions in costly substation upgrades, improving public health, and addressing environmental justice concerns in neighborhoods throughout the state. End quote. So can we look elsewhere for models? Because I think the naysayers may say, that sounds like, you know, sort of green vision pie in the sky, and that it's going to be a lot more difficult to get there, or just a harder time believing that the infrastructure is that convertible. Can we point to other places that are doing this well?
Yeah, well, and I would also just look back at history and just say that, you know, that sounds like what someone in the whale oil industry would have said, or yeah, the lamp oil industry, yes, would have said. And so, yeah, it's inevitable that those voices are going to be there. But the entrepreneurs, anytime there's a challenge, the entrepreneurs say, ooh, I know how to solve that. And then what happens in the energy industry is then you get tripped up by permits and by all these things, by lack of transparency into the utility space. So, for example, let's just talk about some examples. I think that makes it easier. So, you know, there are towns that have old coal plants in New York State that went bankrupt, and now they have this big toxic hulk sitting in their community that could be a resource. It could be repurposed to have batteries and to put solar on the coal ash landfill. And I've had some of these towns in different parts of the state call and say, can you help us? And we say, well, we need to know what is needed on the grid there. How much excess capacity is there on those lines? Is there a need for power quality services that batteries can provide? So that what that means is, you know, people have probably heard about voltage sags or different power quality problems that can maybe damage electronics. So what batteries can do is they can provide all of these ancillary services like frequency regulation that the utilities should pay for. But if the utility won't tell you, well, actually, we could use some voltage control. There's this much capacity. We don't know how much and what type of technology to invest in that place. So, and that's only the state can force the utilities to create transparency so that entrepreneurs in towns and communities can make these investments.
And so do we have to look to Europe for places where this is happening better?
Yeah, and it's really a conversation, because there are things that we're doing better here than they're doing in Europe, and there are things they're doing better in Europe than we're doing here, and that's why I've been part of a transatlantic collaboration for years. In 2014, I took a group of New York State energy specialists to Germany for a week to study, you know, what worked there and what they were struggling with, and I think it's time to do that again.
Okay. And you also write in the piece that deploying advanced energy storage is essential if our state is going to meet its 50% renewable energy and 40% greenhouse gas reduction targets by 2030. Can't do it without it?
No, you can't do it without it because, you know, as Germany's discovered, when you get up into what they would call high penetration of variable renewables, when you get to 40, 50, 60% wind and sun, you have to have a way to balance that. Because if on average, like Germany is now at about a third of their power on average is from the sun and the wind, that means that some days you're way up near 80, 90% and sometimes you're above. And so you either have to export that power to a neighboring market or you have to store it for when it's needed. So, you know, if you want to do this in a way that's cost effective, you have to integrate a whole suite of new technologies.
I have a really interesting email from Andrew. I say interesting because I can't wait to hear Suzanne's answer. I think it's a great question. We're going to get it after our only break here. Andrew wants to know, in regards to the World Bank's change, and if you're just joining us, the World Bank announcing that after 2019, they are not going to fund projects for oil and gas anymore, going away from fossil fuel funding. Andrew's asking, why? What worked? Now, I'm not sure Suzanne was in the room with the World Bank to make when they made that decision, but she has plenty of experience working with people on all sides, whether it's private business or government, and probably has some insight into what works, because we can also talk about what works on a statewide level. What is moving or not moving REV and related issues with the grid? And so I'm very curious to know about what Suzanne Hunt thinks about what is working and what puts pressure on the people who make these decisions, whether it's at the World Bank or in the New York state level or elsewhere. So, Andrew, we'll get your question after the break. Sarah's got a question on the growth of solar locally, so we'll hit that as well. And if you have any questions or comments as we kind of review the year in climate action and look ahead to 2018, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. My guest, Suzanne Hunt, is the president of Hunt Green LLC, and we'll take some of your questions when we come back. Coming up in our second hour, who was Jabba the Hutt? Who was Han Solo? What's the relationship between Luke and Leia? Who was voiced by James Earl Jones? Do you know all of those answers? Are you a Star Wars fan? Are these not the droids you're looking for? Next hour, Star Wars is back. No spoilers. We haven't seen the new film, but we will have fun talking about the Star Wars universe with people who know it and love it and people who know nothing about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest, Suzanne Hunt, works here in New York State, but why don't you remind our listeners what some of the work that you did in Washington for a number of years?
So I worked in Washington for 12 years. For a few years, I worked for some of the large national and international environmental nonprofit organizations. Managed a research project looking at renewable fuels for transportation funded by the German government. We produced a book and went on basically a year-long book tour, speaking tour around the world. And then for the last 10 years, I've been freelance, doing freelance work. So I've worked for, I've actually done some consulting for the World Bank. I've done some consulting for the Inter-American Development Bank, for UN, for Department of Energy, and for investors and little startup clean tech companies. So, you know, to the question about what's working, one of my first thoughts was one of the ways I've seen challenges, you know, breakthroughs with some of these things is where you have really effective, usually has to be face-to-face, kind of walk a mile in the other person's shoes, understand what they're really up against, and what, you know, each stakeholder's constraints are, and then try to, you know, to work together to figure out viable solutions. And we've seen that. You know, we saw that with the universities were at loggerheads with the state over who would own and control RECs, you know, these renewable energy credits. And they sat down and they figured out some kind of compromise that would work for both of them. So that, you know, public-private partnerships have been really effective. And then, you know, in some cases where there just really isn't progress and people are getting really upset, sometimes the direct citizen action, you know, some would argue sometimes it causes people to dig their heels in. And then others would say, no, it actually has created space for people to criticize, because it has been, you know, because New York is out there leading and we want them to succeed. And so it's, you know, everyone, it's been pretty uncomfortable to criticize. But, you know, when some processes are stuck, you know, some of this direct action and really speaking out about what's not working has been helpful.
For people who feel like, what can I do? What you're saying is actual grassroots work can still make an impact. It can make a splash.
Oh, absolutely. But it has to be well-informed. So, you know, the groups that are getting together and they're learning, we were just talking about, you know, energy training sessions so that folks can really feel comfortable that they understand these dynamics and these technologies and these policies.
All right. To the phones we go. David in Pittsburgh. First up, go ahead, David.
It looks like the only kinds of technologies that this group is interested in are the ones that cost a lot of money. And I'll give you a couple of examples here. First, very little is being done in New York State for the V2G vehicle-to-grid function, where when you have an electric vehicle, maybe 10 or 20% of its capacity could be used to boost the grid during the short peak times. Cornell is doing a little work on this, but most, I think, most of the work is being done in Japan, not Europe. And your interviewee there said she was looking to Europe for this. Second thing is a very low-cost thing is have an infrastructure. In other words, when apartment complexes are built, parking lots for apartments are built, they can have low-cost charging stations available so that people wouldn't hesitate to buy an electric vehicle, knowing that it could be charged overnight. So this is just 110-volt systems, which are, you know, relatively inexpensive. And then having building codes where when they build a new house, garages could have a 220-volt breaker box in the garage so that if the owner buys an electric vehicle, he can have an inexpensive charging station installed. So I'm just wondering why they don't look at some of the inexpensive solutions that might very well work with a little thought, as opposed to having to put in these, you know, huge infrastructure changes that they propose.
David, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. Suzanne Hunt, go ahead.
Hi, David. So I think it's not we're talking about apples and oranges a bit. So we're talking about totally different scales. So much of our conversation so far has been about, you know, massive scale, grid scale investments when you're trying to power, you know, cities like New York City. Your suggestions, you know, that those suggestions are fantastic. I drive a plug-in hybrid myself, and so I have been looking at the different you know, level one, level two chargers and costs. And you know, you mentioned building codes. So a lot of these solutions, these local solutions, it takes citizens working with the town councils and changing the zoning rules and the building codes. And so that's a perfect example of things that can be done in the Rochester Finger Lakes region.
Right, so, but these are reasonable ideas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, when I go to, you know, I gave a lecture in Connecticut in September, and they put me up in the university hotel and charged my car overnight in the hotel, you know, and I was charged up in the morning. So it's being done, and it just takes citizens pushing it forward.
David, I'm glad you called. I mean, this is a good example of sort of the both-and approach. You have to look, I from what I understand, listening to people who are far smarter and better schooled than I am in this, you have to look infrastructurally, because we cannot sort of exist on this fossil fuel-based grid forever, or even for much longer, if you want meaningful change and real, you know, sort of change and impact climatologically. But you can also look at those things that Dave is suggesting and should. So I everything that I'm reading anyway. Suzanne?
Yeah. And then also related to both of these last couple of questions, you know, going back to the World Bank question, you know, one of the reasons that they were able to make this decision now is because the cost curves are crossing. Because instead of putting, and what they have traditionally financed in the past are these massive coal plants in, you know, say, Zimbabwe or China. And now it's actually more cost effective to finance solar-powered microgrids, where you basically leapfrog over that enormously expensive, you know, large-scale grid infrastructure. So, you know, part of the transition that we're in is when you shift money away from these old conventional sources and you put a lot more money into the clean technologies, you get economies of scale and the cost curves go down. And so the things that used to be expensive are now, and that's the transition that we're in. All these old assumptions, you know, if you looked at costs 3 years ago, they are wrong now, because it's every single year we're having dramatic cost changes.
Bill in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, guys. I was interested in your views on what Germany's been doing. I've read that they've made a big push towards clean energy using solar and wind and the like. but you just mentioned cost. And I read that the cost for most utility users in Germany have gone up by a multiple of about 3 because these new technologies are so much more expensive than the older ones.
Bill, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked the question, because the story has not been reported fully over here, and so there's a lot of misperceptions. So it is true that Germans pay higher prices for electricity, but it's also true that their homes on average are twice as efficient as the average American home. So they end up paying less out of their pocket for energy because of the investments in efficiency in homes and businesses. So on balance, they're paying less on average than we are. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, you know, looking back, the way they implemented some of their renewable energy policy supports, they were long-term supports, which was essential for investors to put their money in. You know, they had a guaranteed payment for a certain number of years, which allowed them to have the confidence that they'd get a return on their investment. The flip side of that was that they did not anticipate just how fast the cost of technologies like solar and wind would go down. So they were paying much higher prices than they should have been because the cost over time went down so quickly. So what we've been learning from that here is to design policies that phase out or that are tied to some of these costs, so that you don't get stuck paying higher prices than you need to that get passed on to the homeowner or the business owner.
Bill, it's been a little while since I spent some time really reading about what's going on in Germany, but I did earlier this year, and my takeaway from what I was reading at the time was that I think we have to be very careful to do two things. We need to evaluate cost and benefits as we go as best we can. And we have to make sure that we're not just allowing people who want to see bad news take one little thing and blow it into, well, this isn't working. See, the cost for such and such build out is higher, or projections, you know, it didn't meet reality in the first year, so throw it out. There's a little bit of that that goes on when it comes to these new efforts or new directions. And that's kind of what I was seeing with Germany earlier this year when I was spending some time reading it. That was my perception anyway, Suzanne.
Yeah, the other thing that we should mention is that in Germany, a lot of the big companies that have to compete with internationally, like the big, Mercedes and BMW, a lot of those big factories and companies are exempted from a lot of these requirements. So they can just buy the cheapest power. And that's, you know, been controversial within Germany. But there are a lot of carve-outs and nuances to these policies that maybe don't come out in, you know, the discourse over here.
Back to the phones we go. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Susan. I got to tell you, I'm a solar and wind proponent. However, I think the climate change, man-made climate change theory is way blown out of proportion. And I don't think 2017 was a good year because I think the extremists are getting more of a foothold. And I think it's a danger to number one, our economy. A lot of these solar projects that I see are being subsidized by as much as 75%, and maybe even more. I saw one solar project in Wayne County. I think it was Wayne County. It was a $2.2 million project and was subsidized, I think, about $1.7 million. So with these kind of subsidies, to me, we should be let solar and wind compete with fossil fuels until it's more economically feasible.
All right, John.
And let's unleash the private sector. Let's unleash the energy sources we have, such as fracking, natural gas, oil, coal, whatever.
Okay, so
and let them compete.
John, I wanted to take your call because I think your views represent a lot of people who, I'd say a lot of people, by no means majority, but some people who have some confusion over some of these issues. So let me start by asking, and Suzanne, I know we'll have a lot to say, but let me ask you just a couple quick questions. You used the word extremist. So I want to ask you a question. If you were mining something, pulling something out of the ground and using it as an energy source, but then over time you found out that it was just about the dirtiest possible thing that you could do, that workers were living shorter lives, even though they weren't being paid all that well, because of the health impacts of it, that environmentally there were huge costs, and that it was a finite resource, and that it was going away eventually anyway. Would you say that it takes an extremist to then say in 2017, we need to keep doing this and to keep, yes, subsidizing it with your tax dollars. Does it take an extremist to say that?
Yeah, I think it does, because they...
Then why are you not complaining about what's happening at the federal level about that? You just called in to complain about solar and other things. But if you agree
that it takes an extremist... I'm not complaining about solar. I'm not complaining about wind. I'm complaining about the subsidy those two industries are getting.
Are you not under the impression?
If it could be economically done, I'm in favor of it.
Okay.
But I think the it's almost become a dogma of this man-made climate change theory, and that is doing a lot of damage to, as an example, our economy.
I got to cut you off there, because I just don't have the time to waste on the idea that man-made climate change is a theory as we get ready for 2018. But let me also just say one other thing, and we'll turn it over to Suzanne here. John is saying that he wants to see an open competition. He wants to see solar, wind, and all others compete equally. He doesn't like subsidy. He doesn't like his tax dollars going to prop up something that he thinks either should be able to compete or not on its own. That ignores the subsidy for fossil fuels that have been there forever. And the fossil fuel industry writes some of the laws that we have in this country. So they've built in advantages for them. And I don't understand why John and his ilk never seem to want to point that out or deal with that, but because you don't have an open competitive market, as David K. Johnston and others have reported. This is not a perfect free market. We have subsidies everywhere, not just on the alternative side. Okay, Suzanne, go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of don't even want to spend time on this, but, you know, I will say 99% of all climate scientists in the entire world are saying the same thing, that, you know, when you trap more energy in the system, which we know we are, it causes the climate to change.
We don't have to waste time. We know that's true.
99% of the medical doctors in the world telling you that you are sick, that what you are doing is making you sick. Are you going to call them extremists? Are you actually going to respect their expertise, understand that you are not a doctor, and that you don't have the right to an opinion on a technical matter where you have no expertise? I guess it defies logic, the whole conversation. But I think the fact that we now know that hundreds of millions of dollars have been put by the fossil fuel industry into convincing people like the caller of this, that this is some kind of theory that's not true. I mean, their money has been spent effectively. It has worked.
Yeah, the lead industry did this for years.
Tobacco.
They had ostensible scientists testifying to Congress for years. This is a common American story that cycles back through, and some people kind of get caught up in it. And so I appreciate John's call, but that is a common story. But apart from that, he brings up solar, says he's a proponent of solar. So, Suzanne, we had an email from Sarah earlier who said that every time we talk about solar on this program, she thinks about getting an estimate for her house. She's still not done it, and she wants to know if there's still help available and that if it's still growing locally. So, Sarah, thank you for the email. We'll piggyback off John's phone call on solar and ask you how you see the state of solar and what you'd want people to know about that as we head into 2018.
I also want to mention, folks are texting in. You know, we should also mention that, and you started to mention it, Evan, that the current administration is working on subsidizing nuclear and coal because they cannot compete with cheaper solar, wind, and natural gas. So I just want the caller to realize that, you know, that's the reality right now. And as you mentioned, globally but also nationally, we still spend massively more public money on the dirty energy sources than we do on renewables. So taking one project, I don't know if his information was right or not, but to take one project and pretend that is indicative of the nationwide or the statewide picture is just intellectually ridiculous.
Okay, so on the state of things locally for solar, can you answer Sarah's email? She says every time we talk about it, she thinks about getting an estimate for her house, hasn't done that yet.
Yeah.
And is thinking about it again.
Yeah, no, it's great. What I would say is there are a lot of great local companies. There are a lot of big nationwide companies that have a presence in the region. And just it doesn't cost you anything as a homeowner to get a couple of quotes. So I would say, you know, just give a couple of these companies a call and get quotes and then go with the one you're most comfortable with.
Okay. Do you see it still growing? I mean, how do you view solar in sort of a curve where it's headed right now?
Yeah, solar is growing massively. I mean, these last few years, the majority of new energy generation technologies installed in the United States has been solar and wind, more than gas, more than coal. And certainly, you know, there hasn't been new nuclear plants in decades. They're just too expensive. It's still growing. There's certainly challenges. One of the challenges we face, there's been a lot of excitement over the last few years about community shared solar, and that unfortunately has not been growing quickly. The state decided to change how they would compensate solar power for community solar kind of while we were in the middle of trying to get a bunch of projects going. So that threw everyone for a loop. So there's been a lot of setbacks. There's been a lot of challenges for that.
Jim in Rochester points to a Vox article just a couple days ago on the tax bill and renewable energy and wind and solar credits. And he says the following. Evan, following the federal tax bill and what's to come if it's signed into law, it's been revealed that this future legislation would cut federal tax credits by a third or more for clean, green energy projects. Proponents deem these changes as an assault on solar, wind, and even foreign investment in the U.S. in these technologies. Which variable green energies would suffer the most if this tax legislation is passed? And what does Suzanne predict the impact to be on that?
Yeah, thanks for bringing this up. This is, it's so unfortunate because these federal tax incentives were designed to phase out over time. They're exactly the type of incentive. They're not perfect. I would much rather it not be a tax incentive so that folks that, you know, lower income people and businesses can all have the same access to them. So it is not a perfect policy, but it was designed to phase out over time, unlike the fossil fuel subsidies that are permanent. It's going to hurt. You know, I haven't seen the very latest because they're cramming this down everyone's throat so fast you don't have time to keep up. But, it's going to hurt solar and wind. And that's yet another reason why New York has to be effective in how we structure our state markets.
Okay. And he asks, what can be done at the state level through public-private partnerships to offset the impact?
Well, I think one of the things, you know, if we're talking about our wish list, it is the holiday season. One of the things, you know, that one of the situations right now is that the governor has directed the Public Service Commission to implement this target of 50% renewable energy by 2030. But we don't have a state law. So we don't have a state law. So if he decides to run for governor, if he decides to retire, we don't have long-term state laws. And when you're investing in infrastructure and when you're investing in when you're deciding, I had an electric vehicle charging company from Canada trying to decide if they were going to expand into the U.S. If you're making these 10, 15, 20-year plans as an investor and as a business, you need to know what that market looks like. And so if we had a state climate and clean energy policy that includes thermal and transportation, because that's one of the other problems we have is much of the focus has been on electricity when, much more of our greenhouse gas impacts come from thermal and transportation emissions combined than from electricity alone.
All right. So I'll close by asking you this then. The governor calls you tomorrow and says, Suzanne, get thee to Albany. I need to get you in a room with our top people, and you're going to give me three things on the wish list that are going to get done. Right now, three things. They're achievable. They're not pie in the sky, but they move beyond things like Paris, and they put us in line to be one of the leading states in dealing with climate at the state level, and we're going to do it in the next 12 months.
Oh, man.
I know.
I wish I, because the thing is that I don't claim to have all the answers, but I do have a network of brilliant colleagues and collectively.
What you would start doing is dialing those
people. I would
people.
Dial them, and I would bounce everyone's ideas off of everyone and then come up with the best collective answer. But off the top of my head, I would say get a public service commissioner into that spot who really, really lives and breathes this transition and can help the other folks that are already in there who are pushing for this do it faster. I would say putting that storage mandate in place, and you can do it in a way where, you can take all the best experience from other states and other countries and design that mandate such that it does allow for the private sector to come in and, so that we can unleash the private sector in that realm. And then, I would love to see progress towards a statewide you can, if you don't want to call it climate change, call it energy security, call it, you know, readiness for extreme weather, whatever you want to do, but have a statewide policy that helps give certainty to investors and entrepreneurs that we're, that the market isn't going to, that it's going to be here for the long term.
If you want to better understand what's going on with the grid and what New York State might do to move forward with this, the piece in the Times Union was titled All Revved Up with No Place to Go, Where Will New York Store Solar and Wind Energy? We'll link to that. Suzanne was a co-author, and we'll make sure that you can check that out if you like in our various platforms. Suzanne Hunt, who is the president of Hunt Green LLC, thanks for breaking it down for us and a lot more and answering our listeners' questions. Nice having you here. Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Evan.
More Connections coming up next.